from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Ethnicity in America and the Life of William Faulkner. Two conversations this week on Soundings. First, a discussion with John Higham of the Johns Hopkins University about his comparative study of ethnic identities in the United States. Following that, a conversation with Joseph Blotner of the University of Michigan about his biography of the novelist William Faulkner. Here is John Higham.
Well, there are three different ways that people rally, three different sort of touchstones of identification. One is religion, another is race, another is nationality. All of those have to be taken into account somehow or other. Now, one of the problems we have in this country about in our thinking about ethnic groups is that the census has either avoided this question, or else it is focused upon nationality as the defining circumstance, and we often feel quite puzzled about what an ethnic group is if the crux of its identity, for example, is religious. Mm-hmm. Or if there's some mixture of the two involved. And what I particularly want to bring into the story are those people whom the Census Bureau positively discourages mention when they ask, what is your ancestry?
That's because what is confusing to some sort of a bureaucratic system of categorization, and it overlooks some of these more complicated and complicating factors.
There's that. It's hard to count people when what they're referring to isn't unambiguous. But in addition to that, I think our culture has discouraged certain kinds of identification. It's part of our culture. One of the kind of premises of our society that everyone in the United States, except the Indians, is an immigrant, and that reference of all ethnic identities to immigration has enshrined the figure of the immigrant as the sort of classic prototype of American, but lots and lots of people in the United States don't think of themselves in relation to immigration, whatever at all. And I mean by that not just minorities, certain minorities other than Indians. That is, blacks don't have any notion of themselves as immigrants because they came here under coercion, and immigration is ordinarily assumed to have been a voluntary phenomenon. But then there are those millions of people in the United States who really don't care any longer about where their ancestors came from. And if the Census Bureau would allow them to answer this kind of question in an unstructured way, they would be likely to say, I'm a Southerner, or I'm a Midwesterner, or I'm a Yankee, something like that. So that what I want to try to bring into the history of ethnicity in America are these native identities. And what I'm looking for is the cultural ethos that a group has. And I'm interested in not so much in success or failure. I can't ignore that because the groups themselves are very interested. But rather in the ways in which a group maintains itself, the ways in which people survive, or the ways in which they fade out or or shift.
Adapt themselves, and then they may end up fading out, as you say. John Higham, how does what you're doing, you're looking at ethnicity in the United States, how does that feed into this wonderful historical and cultural question of the national character? Is that what you're after, a definition of what it means to be an American? How many commentators have we had going back to Tocqueville, people like that, who look at life in America and say, this is what an American is?
Yes, that's really what, I'm interested in. I hate to admit that I'm studying national character, because that's a bad word these days in scholarly circles. People are not supposed to be pinned down and labeled, and one's supposed to avoid stereotypes. Unfortunately, life doesn't make any sense without certain images of who people are and what they're like. One of my problems in this book is going to be to make a strong enough case to make a sufficiently dramatic presentation of ambiguity, because in our society, identities are so malleable, as you said a moment ago. They are so much in flux. Let's bear in mind that ethnicity is essentially history. It's a subjective history. It's the answer that people give when they're asked, or when they ask themselves, who am I? And the answer to the question of who am I is, where do I come from? What are my antecedents? Of course, a lot of people these days answer this question in along other dimensions. If you ask some people, who are you? They'll say, oh, well, I'm a professor, or I'm a technician. But that's an answer to the question that is phrased in terms of achievement, whereas ethnicity is, as sociologists like to say, ascriptive identity. It's identity that you just simply have, that's there.
We're talking about questions of pride, not necessarily in terms of national origin, but what one has done with one's origins.
Well, what you do with your origins is something else. That has to do with other features of a person's life. But what is just there, what you can't escape, or at least what you think you can't escape, is what's essential. And when you ask people what's essential about them, they'll refer to some of these things that look superficial.
You use the word ambiguity, John Higham. You're looking at ethnicity in America. Don't we have a sort of a schizophrenic proposition here? People want to be part of this larger American whole. We come back to cliches about the melting pot. And at the same time, they want to retain a sense of nationalistic, religious, linguistic, identity, integrity. Is there a way to define the line that separates and combines those apparent polarities?
I think there is. I think the non-ethnic dimensions of America are so strong that they allow all of us to judge our citizenship and our collective life together.
This is sort of a quaint word, citizenship.
According to universals, that is the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, certain moral propositions that we consider everybody to accept. So we have those universal civic norms, and we subscribe to them almost without exception. And that permits an enormous degree of ethnic difference. Ethnicity has to do with difference, because if you ask about what's distinctive about yourself, it can't be the same as other people. So these we can't change our ancestors, and insofar as we live by them and in relation to them, we're divided. Insofar as we live by and with some civic norms, we're united. Ethnicity, therefore, is lots of fun, but it's also dangerous. In our society, the only people who own the turf that they're on are the Indians. So the American Indians are the great exception to the geographical rootlessness of our people. We've frequently made that into a resource, and I think we have to continue to do so.
John Heim, are we talking about insiders and outsiders? Are we talking about the enfranchised and the dispossessed? Mm-hmm. Are we talking about the haves and the have-nots? I take it that those categories in some fashion play into your definition of ethnicity.
Yes, ethnicity is one might say, entirely about who's inside and who is outside. But it's different from haves and have-nots. Because if you talk about who has what in a material sense, you're talking about class. You're talking about up versus down. One of my problems in writing this book is to recognize the importance of class in any society while not allowing it to take over. I want to show that ethnicity is different from class because it has to do with inside versus outside in relation to antecedents, in relation to origins. Class has to do with inside versus outside in relation to aspiration, in relation to where people think they are going.
The here and the now leading us into
yes.
the future.
Yes.
John Heim, to what end do you write this book?
I hope that I can have some influence in encouraging people to take their own identity with a smile.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like people to be proud of where they come from, without thinking of it as the totality of their being. I'd like us as a society to find in the very ambiguity and contradiction of our history the promise of an open future, without being removed from where we are.
Mm-hmm.
We always have to be something in order to become something else, and I'd like the past to be a resource for us without being a prison.
John Heim teaches at the Johns Hopkins University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, John Heim worked on a comparative study of ethnic identities in America. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings continues now with a conversation about the American novelist William Faulkner. My guest is Joseph Blotner of the University of Michigan. Joseph Blotner is the author of Faulkner, a Biography, published by Random House.
Reminisce for me for a moment, Joe Blotner, and tell me some stories about Faulkner, some recollections about the man personally. Then we'll get into the area of translating all of that into a literary biography. What kind of a man was he?
A very complex man. And there are a number of adjectives used often to describe him. He was called a shy man, which in fact he was, literally. He was also capable of being gregarious under the right circumstances. I think one of the things that I think of most strongly in this context is his being a very dedicated artist, a very inner-directed man.
Uh-huh.
So that for one who had spent a lifetime working on his art, one could see this.
Did he see himself, you use the word artist, Joe Blotner, was he an artiste in the sense that devoted to a lot of high-flown theory and preoccupied with defining the nature of what he did and, you know, what is a novel, is the novel going to survive, all that sort of stuff? How did he figure in terms of those questions?
Not in that way at all. Hmm. He had devised over the years a kind of poetics of his own, and when students asked him questions, he would reply with his own literary vocabulary. But actually, he would say often and often, "I'm not a literary man." And although he had educated himself to a great extent by what he called very wide and undirected reading, he was a very sophisticated reader, very much a modernist in terms of the things he had read and in terms of the artist he became. Uh-huh. But as for being a literary man, he was right. It was seen by a number of readers, by a number of professional readers and writers, that he had the tools. That is to say, he could do the kinds of things that Joyce and other modernists could do. He borrowed from the turn-of-the-century poets. He borrowed from Houseman. He was much aware of what the people we regard as world-class writers mm-hmm. were doing. And it, with this technical competency and more, with this technical brilliance, there was an accompanying capacity for dealing over a broad range with aspects of the human condition.
Mm-hmm. Let's bring that, let's locate that, let's put that in the South.
It jumps out at you from the page. And the more the reader knows, it seems to me, about that milieu from which he comes, the more likely is that material to render, make available yet more mm-hmm. to the reader in terms of understanding Faulkner's world. As you say, it is identifiable in space and time, as Joyce's world is. But as Joyce's world extends beyond Dublin, extends beyond Ireland, so does Faulkner's world beyond mm-hmm. North Mississippi, Yakutat County, and the American South. But there are a number of things that can be said in that area, namely that, for one, the American South is an extraordinarily rich ground for the creative writer, for the writer of prose fiction as well as the poet. And the kind of thing that we've seen coming from the American South ever since the so-called Southern Renaissance of the middle 20s tends to bear that out.
Did he see himself as an innovator? Did he talk about that in, you say you knew him at the University of Virginia and you've had access to the family and the papers. How did he talk about himself in those terms?
Well, he would say, or he has been quoted as saying, that the writer does his best to solve the particular problem that is presented in the subject matter which he's handling. Critics have said that Faulkner seemed always to be challenging himself to approach the subject matter for the next book in a new way, that the material demands a certain kind of treatment, so that whereas some writers have trademarks, unmistakable trademarks, which seem to follow through all of their books, Faulkner has characteristic tropes or techniques, yet each of his novels, as the reader looks at them, seem to show this continuing drive to find ways to achieve the artist's task commensurate with the material.
Was he at peace with himself as an artist? Do you think that in his own self he said to himself, "I'm succeeding in what I'm trying to accomplish"? Did he talk about those things?
In response to questions, he developed over the years, as I think anybody would, formulaic answers. Specifically to that question, he would say that the achieved work never matches the dream, the dream of perfection. And in this context, I think of his characterizing The Sound and the Fury, thought of as one of his very best works, as the most splendid failure among those works. However, he had a good deal of pride, and when he looked back on his work in his later years, at one point, looking at a row of books on a shelf in his publisher's home, The publisher said he ran his finger along the spines of the books and said, not a bad monument to leave behind.
Joe Blotner, we're talking about literary biography and William Faulkner. How do you figure out the difference between the life and the work as you put down Faulkner's life on paper? What was your objective? Chronology, interpretation? How do you blend the two, separate them when necessary?
My purpose in the only justification for the biography was the work. And therefore, that was the thing that I tried to keep rather in primary focus, so to speak. Now, one has to, in order to make the work understandable, look at the life and see the way in which the two interface with each other. And reading some of Faulkner's novels, such as The Reavers, for instance, his last one, it is very clear that he was drawing, as he did in other books, upon his family, upon his town, upon his region. But it seemed to me that I had to do a number of things. I had to present him against his region, against his his Jotnapatawpha, so that the hardest thing to do, to pick up what you said a moment ago, was to try to find out exactly what the process within that crucible was. Faulkner himself wrote to a young friend, I don't know myself where it came from, how I came to be the vessel of this. And so it seemed remarkable to him, although he knew very well how much he'd read, how much he'd studied, how much he'd tried to do.
Joe Blotner, the academics, particularly the literary critics and literary historians, are having great fun these days with lots of 50-cent words like deconstruction and hermeneutics and, oh goodness, you can put a whole long list on the table. Words really have no meaning. Words are signifiers that fall apart. We have these endless spirals between the message. In the message between the expressive voice and the audience. What do you make of that in terms of Faulkner's writing? And by extension, I'll ask you to put yourself on thin ice. What do you think Faulkner would have made of that?
I don't think he would have had much truck with it. And it seems to me that those of us who run into these terms become aware at some point of changing fashions in literary criticism, as in many other areas. Looking back, you can think of a number of phrases. Of course, the new criticism, so-called, is the first one that comes to my mind. Essentially, I think Faulkner would have said, the writer consistently tries to do the best he can to represent experience. He said, for him, the most moving things. And for a literary critic to say that words have very little meaning or are capable of so many different meanings that it is very difficult to determine to any degree the writer's intent, or that one can profit from a phrase I just heard the other day, creative misreading. This seems to me poppycock.
Oh, goodness.
Faulkner would have none of it, and for myself, that's not my area of interest.
Joe Blotner, let's conclude our conversation. Tell me a story about Faulkner. Do you a favorite recollection or anecdote, a story that he might have told on himself? Illustrate this man for me a little more concretely.
It's hard to pick one story, and I will not attempt to do this in an emblematic fashion. I'll just tell you something off the top of my head about a side of him that would not seem to be the way one would think of Faulkner. A reader, let's say, in the 50s or the 60s, he came to the University of Virginia as writer-in-residence, as I said. He was doing his own work when he wasn't fox hunting or when he wasn't in class. He completed there work on the town, on the mansion, worked on the Reavers. So he was a working writer. At the same time, he took very seriously, very conscientiously, his responsibilities, his obligations. He met classes, and one of my colleagues would come to me and say, do you think we could get Mr. Faulkner to come into my sophomore class because my students are reading The Unvanquished and they'd like to ask him some questions? And they would, these 18, 19-year-olds, and he would do the best he could to remember what he had meant, perhaps mm-hmm. 30 years ago, or to address conscientiously the questions that they put to him. And we didn't know how it would go. He didn't know how it would go.
Was he comfortable with his public in that sense?
He said at the first session he was terrified. Mm. He was afraid that it would not go. But very soon the chemistry began to work. And this small anecdote towards which I'm moving relates to what happened about 2 months after he was there. He had met all the classes we'd asked him to meet. And one day he said to me and to Fred Gwynn, my colleague, "Do you think it would be all right if I came in and held office hours a couple of times a week?" Now, here is this man thought to be very much a recluse, thought to have a rather bitter view sometimes of human experience. Mm-hmm. Moving in that environment, interacting with young people whom he liked very much, and giving very freely of himself. In his work, in those books, in that row of books whose spines he pointed to and said that's a good monument to leave behind, he gave of himself, and so in his life he did too.
Joe Blotner, a very quick footnote to our conversation. Why do you remember William Faulkner?
I remember him for two reasons, I suppose. One, because his work is to me so compelling, because it is so broad gauge, because it is so world class, it has so much to keep on giving. That's one reason. And the other reason is the pleasure with which I look back and think of the way in which he has profoundly changed my life, for which I am profoundly grateful.
Joseph Blotner teaches at the University of Michigan. Joseph Blotner is the author of Faulkner, a biography published by Random House. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 418. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, conversations about the philosophy of science and about childhood in ancient Greece. My guests will be Marjorie Green of the University of California at Davis and Mark Golden of the University of Winnipeg. Here's news of interest to high school teachers. In June and July of 1989, the National Humanities Center will sponsor 2 3-week seminars for high school teachers of history and literature. The history program will examine the evolution of republicanism. The literature program will explore literature and its audiences. For more information, write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The first week in October marks birthday anniversaries for James Lawrence, the American naval officer whose last battle ended in defeat, but whose final words, "Don't give up the ship," endure. Lawrence was born in 1781. For the cartoon characters, Charlie Brown and Snoopy, who first appeared during the first week in October 1950. And for Mohandas Mahatma Gandhi, the Indian politician and spiritual leader, who was born during the first week in October 1869. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Partial support for Soundings comes from The Leader, News of the Research Triangle. Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Ethnic America and Remembering Faulkner. Two conversations this week on Soundings. Listen for John Higham of the Johns Hopkins University and Joseph Blotner of the University of Michigan. John Higham discusses his comparative study of ethnic identities in America. Joseph Blotner talks about his authorized biography of the writer many critics call America's greatest novelist. Ethnic America and Remembering Faulkner. Next on Soundings.